I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Who doesn't feel inundated, even assaulted, by data coming at us from every which way, all that social media on all of our devices calling us calling for us to respond and respond now? And don't forget the demands of the analog world between work and home and dropping off the kids at daycare or school or soccer or checking in on mom and dad at the nursing home. It's easy to feel stressed and burned out, like you're working all the time and getting nothing done because something is always vying for your attention. It's a common lament these days. That's why we booked Jenny Odell and Rob Walker to be our guests. They have a lot to say and a lot to suggest about how to find enjoyment and calm in today's harried world. Rob Walker is an advice columnist for Life Hacker, and he's on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts, wrote a book called The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. And Rob Walker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us also is Jenny Odell. She's a multimedia artist, a writer, and she's the author of a book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And Jenny Odell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me start with you, Rob, but Jenny, I'd like to hear from you as well. And it's funny, when you look back 100 years or even more, you find this common lament that everything is vying for our attention. We're just distracted all the time. Is there something unique about the time that we're living in now?
Yeah, I mean, it's true, you can find those complaints going back quite a ways, and perhaps 100 years from now, it will still be going on, and there will be new things for us to complain about. But I think that there's no question that year over year, the ways we can be distracted and the number of sort of entities seeking are able to distract us keep metastasizing. And of course, the big culprit that we all look at immediately is our phones.
Sure. Beckoning to us all day long.
Yeah.
So, Jenny, how much should we just blame technology, or is it more complicated than that?
I think that it is probably more complicated, but what is genuinely new, I would say, is maybe the extent to which, or maybe the extent of the technology and how granular it is. Like, you know, when I use the phrase attention economy in the subtitle of my book, the attention economy, it's really, you know, that could just be the history of advertising. Like anything where, you know, people have studied how to catch and hold other people's attention. But, you know, what we have now is like, you know, an extremely detailed and granular version of that, where it's no longer even restricted to advertising. It's like every, you know, aspect of how you communicate with other people or express parts of your life is filled with notifications, and almost like a gamified character. So I would say it just feels almost more embedded in daily life than it did before.
The idea that someone is buying or selling our attention. I think that's what you write in your book, Jenny.
Right. And again, I mean, you could say that is, you know, not unique to social media, but that social media has maybe found like a uniquely effective way of doing that.
You know, Rob, I was thinking of my phone, which calls to me all day long. And I was also thinking about the psychology classes I took in college about intermittent reinforcement. And the hardest behavior for a rat to change was when they were intermittently reinforced. Sometimes it was good news. Sometimes it was bad news. Sometimes it was a pellet. Sometimes it was a shock. But that was the hardest behavior to undo. And I'm wondering whether we're kind of rats in a maze these days.
You're going with the upbeat approach to
this. Well, we'll get to the upbeat, but yes.
No. Yeah. No, I'm sure that there's some truth to that. And obviously, you know, part of what Jenny is talking about is relevant here, that you could not only get notifications from the news or from advertisers, but, you know, literally friends and acquaintances and people you work with. And then there's this pressure to feel like, well, I bet, you know, they call it the so-called fear of missing out, which is not a totally irrational thing.
No.
There are good reasons why you want to be aware of what your peers and tribe are up to. But unfortunately, you know, you don't need to be aware of them all the time. And one of the problems to me that I focus on a lot, or that I find the most disturbing about the way that this, you know, as attention economy works now, and I found this with students, is that they would feel that if they were noticing something and everybody else wasn't talking about it, it wasn't trending, that it must not be important. And I think that's a really catastrophic conclusion, not just for designers, which the students I teach are design students, but for anybody, because really noticing the things that other people aren't paying attention to yet, that other people have overlooked, is kind of an important part of being a person.
Well, in fact, that's part of the message of your book, The Art of Noticing, seeing things that other people don't see.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that came kind of out of the class that I teach, and it's something I believe in pretty strongly. And yeah, it's a theme that runs through the book. And I was a little frustrated at the time. I started doing the book because I was a little frustrated with most of the advice that I was hearing about this subject. And this is obviously before Jenny's book had come out. But if her book had come out, maybe I wouldn't have bothered to write mine. But I was mostly seeing advice that had to do with denial, with like what to quit and what to throw away and how to take a sabbatical. And I wasn't seeing a lot of advice about what to do that would be appealing or informative or helpful or just fun.
Well, in fact, that's the reason we wanted both of you on, because both of you, including you, Jenny, you're saying while this technology is trying to grab our attention all the time, the solution is not to toss our devices into the local river or down the toilet. We have to figure out how to live with all this stuff, right?
Right. Well, not only that, I think that if you make it about trying to quit using your phone, you're still thinking about it. Like, you're still existing on the same plane. Like, it's the sort of classic, like, quitting Facebook and posting about it on Twitter.
Right.
You haven't actually exited the problem. And so I, as an artist, a lot of my work is driven by and tries to produce curiosity. And I've always found curiosity a really powerful tool. It's almost like the flip side of fear. Like, both fear and curiosity are attitudes toward the unknown. And curiosity really can, I mean, even morbid curiosity. Like, I like to get morbidly curious about advertising. Like, sometimes I will look at my own ads as if they were written by, a sci-fi author 20 years ago writing about a dystopian future. I think that directing curiosity towards anything, including oneself and one's own habits, already introduces a kind of separation between the self and those habits, a kind of interruption that can allow you to look at what you're doing. Like, even sometimes when I've been on my phone for a while, I just think about what my face looks like. What has my face looked like for the last 5 minutes? It's often frowning. We're looking at other people's faces when they look at their phones. So I think that there's just a lot that curiosity can do there beyond just kind of like punishing oneself for how much you use your phone.
Right. I mean, that's not particularly helpful. Let me go back to you, Rob Walker. And one of your book is full of things to do, things to think about doing. I tried one this morning as I was walking to work, and you said, look up. look up. And I saw, oh my goodness, I saw the tops of some beautiful buildings on Market Street in Philadelphia that are probably 100 years old with these lovely little architectural details. But I also got the feeling, and I think both of you really say this, is think how you or act the way you are when you're a tourist and you're in a new place and you don't know where anything is.
Yeah, or like a child.
Or like a child.
Is another way of thinking about it. And yeah, so the my publisher doesn't like it when I call them assignments. But so there's 131 prompts or provocations or whatever, and some of them are just that simple. And it's by intent, is to have things like just add looking up to your day, or just tomorrow look for the color red everywhere you go, or look out a window that you always ignore. To be sort of, these are meant to be like little gateway things that are fun. Some of them are more involved. But the point is that instead of reaching for your phone to see which YouTube stars are feuding on Twitter today, give yourself a little reward and give yourself a break. Even a small one can make a big difference. And yeah, think about how often you walked past these things, the architectural details you're talking about, and never noticed them, and now you've added a little something to your day.
I sure did. That's Rob Walker. He's an advice columnist for Lifehacker, author of a book called The Art of Noticing. Jenny O'Dell is with us as well. She's a multimedia artist, a writer, and she's the author of a book called How to Do Nothing. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jenny, what is nothing? When you say the art of doing nothing, what does that entail besides nothing?
It can, you know, it can really be anything as long as it's not goal oriented. That's how I usually define it. So maybe a good example is walking somewhere versus going for a walk. So if you're walking somewhere, you're probably trying to take the most efficient or the fastest route, and you've achieved your goal when you've gotten to the destination. Whereas going for a walk, if you really wanted to go for a long walk and you were just ending up back at your house, you would probably choose the most inefficient route, or an inefficient route anyway. And you would, you know, for me, when I go for a walk, it's just for the purposes of looking around. So I've already achieved my goal once I'm walking. So pretty much, you know, all of the things that I describe, at least myself doing in the book, fall into that category. Mm-hmm. Like bird watching is another example where the goal is to see birds, but there's not, you know, it's just sort of a state of openness in which you may see something or you may not. And just to add to that point about looking up or architectural details even, I recently went on a historical walking tour of the neighborhood, the sort of waterfront in Oakland where my studio is. And I consider myself very familiar with that area, and I do go for walks there. And I was so almost embarrassed and humbled by how little I knew about that neighborhood.
Wow.
In
wow.
particular, that it's an industrial neighborhood. And so the tour guide pointed out that the roofs there are kind of domed almost in a way, like to create more space inside the warehouse. And she was like, you know, when you take BART to the city, just look towards the water and you'll see like these hills and mountains of these roofs. And sure enough, you know, I took BART yesterday, which is normally, you know, I look out and I see like the normal things I look at, like the port and the water. And I just could not believe that I had not noticed this very obvious aspect of the landscape. Like, I don't know what I thought the roofs looked like, but I clearly just wasn't looking at them. And so I really love having that kind of experience. And that is definitely something I would also classify as, you know, quote unquote, not doing nothing, but right. You're not doing something, you're noticing something.
Well, it's so interesting, Rob, to be so familiar with a place but not have seen certain things about it.
Yeah, and I've had a couple of experiences like this. I think I can't remember if I left it in the book or not, but there was the suggestion of be a tourist in your home, to, like literally try to be a tourist in your hometown. And we used to live in Savannah, and it's a very – I thought I knew it pretty well, but I had a cousin visiting, and we actually took like the kind of – the corny bus tour that you would never take. And it was such a blast. And we learned so much about the hometown.
About your own hometown, right.
But also, I'll put in a word for kind of less traditional. One of the things that got me started on this whole process was a trip to San Francisco, which is a city I have visited a number of times. So I'm sort of familiar with the architecture and no longer in that kind of jaw-drop mode. And I was going to be really busy, and I wanted to give myself some kind of assignment, looking assignment. And my one parameter was that I wanted to look for something that no one particularly wanted me to look for. So I chose security cameras, and just like everywhere I went, I would look for security cameras. And it really, this kind of thing really shifts your view of, first of all, how pervasive they are, but it has you looking at a streetscape in a different way. It has all these, and I had no real point to this, to sort of go with what Jenny was saying earlier about doing nothing. I'm a big fan of, like, you don't have to be productive all the time. Yeah. I think people are too obsessed with, and that's where social media comes in, because it feels productive somehow. Like, well, at least I'm getting through my Instagram feed. That's not really producing anything. And sometimes it's nice to give yourself a break and shift perspective and find out what you're missing and how it might, you know, pay off for you in other ways.
Oh, that's interesting, because, Jenny, you also look at productivity, kind of trying to reframe it, I think, for us.
Yeah, I ask the question in my book, you know, when we say the word productivity even, and I should add that I'm basically from Silicon Valley, so I've been very...
you know productivity, yeah.
Yeah, I'm steeped in productivity culture, and at a certain point I kind of ask, like, productive of what, why, and for whom? And once you kind of start to ask these questions, our version of productivity, at least the traditional version, starts to look very narrow. For example, like, you could have a lot of companies very productively, you know, being very productive financially, that are maybe destroying the planet, or, you know, an industrial farm that is very productive of products, of food, but it's depleting the soil. And so, you know, from a certain other perspective, it's very unproductive. And so I am questioning that the assumptions around our normal idea of productivity and kind of trying to propose a different idea of productive, which is a productivity that is cognizant of the roles of caring and maintenance and, you know, regeneration and sustaining systems that might from a certain perspective look backward or more like restoration, but that from the perspective of collective well-being would look like productivity.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And another way even to think about our economy. Rob, let me go back to you and get to a couple of more assignments, as you call them. Jenny was talking about just taking a walk with no particular purpose. I think about, you know, GPS, we use them. I have to say, when I'm in a strange place, I'm always happy to have it because then I know I won't get lost. But I hear or I read in your book about just that there's nothing wrong with getting lost from time to time. In fact, maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it can be. And to talk about it is at least try to get there the hard way sometimes. I'm not the first person to talk about this, that the way that we rely on GPS kind of messes with our ability to understand space that we're moving through and how it relates to other spaces that we've been in. And there are all these terrible stories of people following their GPS instructions and driving like directly into the lake or
because
the
they're looking at their phone kind
terrible
of thing.
They're just so convinced that whatever it's telling them must be the right thing to do. And especially when I'm in a new place, I do always try to make it a point to take at least one, if not completely phoneless, then one phone minimal walk. You know, I don't actually want to get completely lost in a strange place, but you know, to give yourself that time. And it's to go to the point about productivity and how to define it. It's about discovery and curiosity and leading yourself to conclusions or to epiphanies that you wouldn't have if you were doing everything the most efficient way. It's almost a determined inefficiency that I think you can look for sometimes.
Let me read a couple of comments. I'll reintroduce you and we'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Bill says, a lesson on being deliberate that I learned from a tracker was to keep my eyes wide open and to look for things that I did not normally look for. Really underscoring, Rob, what you were saying. An email from Ronald. As a retired teacher, recent technology, especially since the introduction of the smartphone, has been a game changer. Grades in my class dropped. Fewer A's and B's, more C's and D's. Students are less intelligent. They're less focused and more easily distracted. I know that's a common lament in many schools. We're talking with Jenny O'Dell. She's a multimedia artist. She's a writer, and she's the author of a new book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Rob Walker is with us as well. He's an advice columnist for Life Hacker. He's on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts, and he's got a book, too, called The Art of Noticing, 131 Ways to Spark Creativity, Find Inspiration, and Discover Joy in the Everyday. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Send us more emails, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with Rob Walker and Jenny O'Dell. Jenny, you mentioned birdwatching, and that seems an important part of I guess, a discovery that and a way of paying attention that seems very central to your book.
It is, and I'm now realizing it also fulfills the assignment of looking up because you're often having to look up into trees. But yeah, it's really it's speaking of that kind of humbling factor that I was mentioning earlier. I have been humbled in the last couple of years, just in terms of realizing, you know, that I wasn't noticing bird sound at all. And then I was noticing it. Then I can make out maybe three or four, then maybe five or six different birds. And then at this point it's, you know, same bird, different times of the year. And I think this process could just kind of go on and on. Like your attention could become more and more specific, where there could be more points, within your attention, almost like higher resolution or something. And I really enjoy the state that it sort of requires, which is that it's, you know, of course the term is bird watching, but right. As I say in the book, it's really, it should be called bird noticing, because So often you hear something first, and then you look for it. You also have to look at things like, you know, what kind of tree is it in? How is it moving around? What time of year is it? It sort of requires you to be extremely aware of everything around you as contextual information. And it's interesting because it's, you know, like the phrase doing nothing, it's, for some people it sounds lazy, but although I find bird watching to be very calming, it does require a state of alertness that I would not describe as passive or lazy, that it's actually, but I also wouldn't describe it as work. So it's kind of something in between where I am not producing anything or feeling obligated to produce anything, but I'm also very present and very aware of everything that's around me and not kind of lagging on that.
I mean, it seems very almost meditative or, you know, that's the mindfulness, you know, part of paying attention.
Yeah, I think it shares a lot in common with more maybe traditional mindfulness practices. And it's just that I sort of came to it almost in a roundabout way. Even the way that I started bird watching, it wasn't like one day I set out to become a bird watcher. It was just that I happened to live in a neighborhood where you almost can't not, you have to notice them. They're everywhere. And at a certain point I just became curious, like, okay, what's that weird little green bird? And then that was like, you know, my gateway bird.
And what was that little green bird?
So it's not actually green. I realized that it's greenish. It just is because of the time of day that I saw it. It was a cedar waxwing. And they're here in the winter, especially, or the almost, you know, all year except for the summer. And again, this I find this experience to be both pleasant and sometimes embarrassing, which is like I saw one. I figured out what it was. I got really excited. And then I saw a few more, and I actually pulled this lady over who was walking down the street, and I was like, look it, those are cedar waxwings. They're so amazing. And they are really amazing, but they're also pretty common here. And she was like, yeah, cedar waxwings, you know. And then I like slowly realized that I had actually been seeing them everywhere, every year, and I'd heard that sound everywhere.
Oh, but now you can recognize it. It's so interesting. Rob, let me go back to you, and one of your assignments in this book is take a photo walk with no camera. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, it was inspired by reading one of these sort of, you know, sets of tips on the internet about how to take better pictures, and it made me think these are all really interesting ideas, but maybe if you did them without the camera, it would be even more interesting. You were just forced to, you know, look at a situation and think about the shadows, kind of find the framing in it that you want. And then just tell yourself, like, okay, that's a picture, and move on to the next thing. And we spend so much time documenting the world that we don't really appreciate it. We just sort of want to record it. But I want to – can I pick up on the bird song thing for a second?
Of course,
One of the way the book is organized, it actually does start out with all visual stuff, because I think that that's our first instinct, is to think of noticing and to think of the visual. But it does then move explicitly into other senses. So it's a really valuable point to talk about. You know, bird song is a great gateway thing to get people to awaken their other senses. And some of the assignments in the book get a little more involved. One of them is to make a neighborhood sound map. But even if you don't do that, if you give yourself that general prompt, at least for me, that has had the effect of thinking a lot about, like, sort of listening at my neighborhood in a different way. And that does involve birdsong, but also, you know, I live fairly close to a train track, and there's a drawbridge that you can hear sometimes. And then also, you know, my neighbor Peter likes to talk on his front porch to whoever's walking by. And it becomes interesting to think of your neighborhood just in terms of sound. And it's just a different way of engaging with the world.
Well, I'm a radio person. I'm a sound person, obviously.
Sure.
But I'm thinking also what you said about, you know, looking without a camera. And I am embarrassed to say this. Sometimes I've been on a trip where I so quickly whip out my camera to capture a scene that, of course, I look at when I get home, but kind of realizing, gosh, maybe I really missed actually looking at it.
Yeah, and I read somewhere that at least you're looking at the picture when you get home. It's not every picture that's taken gets even looked at this point, which is kind of a sad comment. And there are spaces that are now built, I guess, to make them more Instagrammable. And I'm not against taking pictures. I'm not against photography. I'm not against documenting your life. But again, I feel like maybe if you deny yourself that every once in a while, it might trick up the way that you're engaging with the world around you.
Let me read a comment from Maria, and then we'll get some callers in. Maria says, I had an eye-opening experience on a vacation to Europe a few years ago. I took hundreds of photos, but my kids' photos were from such a different perspective and captured very different things, like the shape of the toilet in our hotel room. It was great to compare our perspectives. Rob is someone who teaches at the School of Visual Arts. What do you say?
Kids can be brilliant, and that they haven't seen it all. They don't know. They haven't, taken in the set of mores and quote unquote rules about what counts as interesting and what doesn't. They're very interested in the world, and it can be a great thing to try to look at the world with that childlike perspective, especially if you have access to an actual child to pay attention to how they're paying attention to the world. And I hope I'll be forgiven for this leap. I don't have kids, but I kind of try to do this with my dog because I walk my dog every day.
Sure.
And, we're walking the same basic territory. And it helps keep me engaged if I can just try to pay attention to what he's paying attention to and, what he's wanting to smell and trying to figure out why he's trying to do it. I mean, usually the answer is he's trying to eat something. But
well, I was just saying he's not looking up. He's probably looking down, right?
No, he's not looking up. He looks up with his nose.
Yeah, exactly. Let me get Matthew from Elverson, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. And Matthew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. One of the things I'm really concerned about these days is the concept of siloing, where people get through the internet and social media trapped in a circle of things that only reinforce what they want to see or hear. And I wonder how the guests think of this distractibility as it relates to this concept of siloing.
That's a really interesting question, Matthew. I'm going to see what Jenny Odell has to say. Jenny, as an artist, what do you think?
So I actually have a little section of my book specifically about this, where I describe being, I think I use the word entombed in your algorithmic recommendations. So as a thought experiment, I imagine that I only listen to Spotify and I like, I listen to my Discover Weekly, right? And I like all the songs that I like, and it would just become more and more sort of an archetypal mix of things that I like within that context. And I contrast that with the fact that I listen to the radio in the car because I don't have an aux input in my car. And I listen to community radio stations, one of which I found out recently the DJs are actually required to play like 3 or 4 different genres of music in one show. And I will often, I don't like everything that I hear, but I will often hear something that I not only like, I like in ways and for reasons that I don't understand, which for me in that moment reminds me that I am actually something more than, a personal brand that has very stable likes and dislikes. I'm actually a sort of like shifting entity that is open to influences, and that there are parts of me that are, I have not yet discovered or have not yet been formed because I haven't encountered these unexpected things. And so that's why I put so much emphasis in the book on public spaces where you could conceivably talk to other people. I have an ode to the bus system in the East Bay. I'm a big fan of the bus. But I think, these are just important counterbalances to, this idea that you could very easily, even when you're not, expressly on your phone, that you could live your whole life only paying attention to things insofar as they matter to you in a very narrow sense, or that they could be used by you. There's a writer named Byung-Chul Han, whose book I just read, it's called The Agony of Eros, and he uses this phrase, the inferno of the same, to describe the situation the inferno of the same is that in which you only ever really encounter yourself reflected back at yourself, and you never are surprised or encounter something truly outside of yourself.
Oh, I love that. The inferno of the same. Anything you want to add to that, Rob?
No, that was pretty good. I think, it's a variation on that efficiency theme from earlier. And it's a little bit sad the way that the algorithm shapes our consumption so much of the time now. And what it does is level out or make much less likely the, you know, luck, chance, serendipity that, if you think about it, probably is a highlight of many cultural experiences that you've had, or you know, that's what discovering something is really about, is having it come to you in an unexpected way and not knowing that you were going to like it. There's no, like, it's hard to imagine the algorithm that would deliver bird song into your life.
Sure. You know. Matthew, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Chris from Frankfurt has to say. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi there, Chris.
Oh,
go
hi.
Ahead.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Your discussion just reminded me of something that happened when I was very young. I was working at a restaurant in South Philly, and I was only there for a few weeks when I had to go on a trip to go pick up some provisions, I think, for the bar, along with a guy who had been doing this for years. And I had never been in that neighborhood before, and, you know, to exemplify what you're talking about almost hilariously, I noticed that a few blocks from the place where we were picking up the provisions, someone had built the front of an airplane, an actual airplane, into their home. At least I think it was a home. But there was a fuselage, the front nose and pilot's cabin of an airplane.
Wow.
Which the guy I was going with had never noticed before. So I thought, well, that kind of gets to what you're talking about. Yeah, this really happened. So
yeah, it's great, Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah, lucky.
Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Okay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, Jenny, sounds like sort of like some of your experiences out there in Oakland.
Yeah, and I think you can have this experience within yourself where, you know, like new you is embarrassed at old you. Or, you know, this is one of the things that happens, I think, when people have friends come visit them, maybe for the first time from another city, where, you know, you just have a different pair of eyes looking at things. I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about with children. And I have to confess that part of this time I've been watching some crows outside my window.
Oh.
Because if you've read the book, you know that I have some, I wouldn't call them pet crows, but crows recognize human faces and remember them. And so I basically have known these crows for about 3 years, and I see them, they come here at this time every morning and for a peanut. But I was looking at one of them and thinking about, you know, whenever I look at them, I think about what they see. Like, I think about their perspective on my apartment building, which otherwise looks very boring. And paying attention to them has helped me notice the shape of the hill that I live on, which is pretty steep, but it's not really a straightforward kind of lump, right? It has a shape, and I can see them negotiating, you know, like, where are all the really tall redwood trees, or what are the good roofs to land on? And so just spending time looking at them has kind of had that effect on me on just like my own street.
We are almost out of time. And Rob, just one little section in your book having to do with others. We've been talking about all these devices that, you know, that demand our attention, but the importance of focusing on the people in our lives.
Yeah, well, actually, this all ties together, the last couple of points, because, you know, one of the things that you can learn by, or one of the ways that you can sort of reframe how you see the world is to try to see it through someone else's point of view, and that can be true in terms of what you read online, and it can be true in terms of one of the suggestions in the book is to take a walk with an expert on another subject, which can be a really eye-opening experience. Talk with someone who really knows a lot about plants if you don't know a lot about plants, and they're going to see your neighborhood in a completely different way than you do.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Rob Walker, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's an advice columnist for Life Hacker on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts, the author of a book called The Art of Noticing. Jenny O'Dell, thank you very much for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And she's a multimedia artist, she's a writer, and she's the author of a book called How to Do Nothing. And we appreciate all those calls and comments to Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Help today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Here's some Otis Redding.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting in the evening come, watching the ships rolling. I'll watch them roll away again.
the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, and I headed for the Frisco Bay. 'Cause I've got nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide